From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti dropped the city's proposed budget. And because of the pandemic, you can guess that LA's financial picture is not pretty. We'll hear what makes the cut and what's getting cut so that the city stays afloat. Plus, coronavirus news is constantly evolving, which can lead to lots of questions. Good thing we've got experts with all the answers. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Monday. A lot happening. We're going to dive right in. Coronavirus has put a stop to most regular economic activity, and that means no taxes or fees to keep local governments running. That stark reality was the backdrop of LA Mayor Eric Garcetti's State of the City speech Sunday, previewing the release of the city's new budget today. And he said this.
I always say that budgets are a statement of our values. But this year, it is also a document of our pain.
The mayor's proposed city budget just dropped about 30 minutes ago, and our senior politics reporter Libby Denkman has the first crack at explaining what's in it and how deep the cuts will go. Libby, welcome back.
Hey, A.
Now, last week, the controller said LA was facing hundreds of millions in revenue shortfalls. Now with the city planning for the next fiscal year, it's really time to face the music. So how bad is this going to get?
Right. Revenues have plummeted, as you mentioned in the intro. And in his State of the City speech yesterday, the mayor said this will be a more painful time than the city saw after the Great Recession. That's quite a statement. He was emotional when he was describing everything Angelenos are going through, including the loss of life. The math is pretty cruel. Local governments can't print money. The mayor simply has to find the savings. So yesterday he said he would continue a hiring freeze and furlough nearly all civilian city workers, except for a few departments. That's over 15,000 people facing 26 days off or losing 10% of their salary. Civilian city workers, so not police, fire, those types of jobs. Now, that's tough, but that still wasn't going to balance the budget for the rest of the year. So the mayor said the city also has to borrow from the reserve fund to cover that gap. On top of all of it, there's been almost $58 million in emergency spending so far to address COVID-19, including expanding homeless shelters, getting people into hotels, setting up testing sites across the city as well. This spending should be reimbursed by the federal government through money in the CARES Act, passed by Congress and signed by the president. But for now, it also adds to the city's budget challenges, along with lost revenue. All told for this fiscal year, A, that ends in June, again, this fiscal year, the city found $194 million in savings. But there's another major challenge looming starting when the next fiscal year begins July 1st.
Right. So what about next year? The mayor gave us a preview in his State of the State speech, and it sounded like the city was left with really tough choices to make.
Yes, the proposed budget the mayor just released includes $230 million in hard cuts to department budgets in the next fiscal year. That's compared to the mayor's early March budget estimates. So name a department and there will be a cut, except for just a few key exceptions. Street services will be reduced by 20%. Most of that is via not filling open positions, not replacing employees who leave. Tree services are going to be cut back. LADOT's Vision Zero, which is aiming to reduce traffic deaths in the city, that's going to have a $3 million cut. Infrastructure spending across the board has been cut. You know, they talked about 311 wait times going up for people who live here and want to call the city and get to the right department. Maybe you want to report a pothole. Operators for 311 are subject to furlough, and so are the city workers of all the departments they might direct you to. You know, it goes to gang reduction programs and communities. The list goes on and on, A, cuts really across the board.
And you said there were exceptions. What are those exceptions?
Yes. So I mentioned sworn police officers and firefighters. They're in the clear. The library system, that will not see cuts. The Bureau of Sanitation and the Department of Building and Safety are spared. And there are also exceptions for EMS workers with the fire department, nurses at the fire department, so civilian workers at the fire department that are there for health and safety reasons, detention officers, And homelessness spending. I just got off the phone with our homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Homelessness spending by the city will actually remain pretty steady. But Matt reminded us that, you know, city spending in total of the county spending, that is, that mostly comes from the sales tax revenue that goes to Measure H, and that's really county money. So when you talk about keeping city homelessness spending steady, that doesn't mean that funding in all of LA County will stay steady. We'll have to check in with the county about that budget.
Really quick, Libby, it's 15,000 workers, right? I got an email from someone that said, did she say 50? They sound the same, but it's 15, right, to be clear.
15,000 workers, and that's the civilian workers who work for the city. Again, not police and fire, not fire, health and safety workers that work with those departments. And it's 26 furlough days for the civilian city workers that work for the city of LA.
All right, so there you go, 15,000. Now, what else can be done to avoid losing city services? I mean, is there any conversation about a tax or a federal bailout possibly?
There is clearly a lot of hope that Washington will come up with some money to bail out cities. There was $150 billion of money for states, counties, and cities in the second round of CARES Act funding from Congress. And that money is getting to local municipalities. They have to apply to the Treasury Department for it mostly. But that is restricted to emergency expenditures directly related to COVID. So it can't be used to bridge a revenue shortfall like what LA is facing. When it comes to taxes, though, you know, LA city voters just rejected a parcel tax for schools less than a year ago. You'll remember last June. And that was when the economy was really humming along nicely. Since then, hundreds of thousands of LA County workers have lost their jobs. The appetite to vote for a tax, it's just probably not there right now. I haven't heard a lot of conversation about it.
Everything is pretty tough to hear. I'm wondering what you're hearing in terms of reaction to all this.
It really is, it's a difficult time. Well, I spoke to Coral Iskali with SEIU Local 721. That's the union that represents a large chunk of civilian public workers in town. She said furloughs are not the way to go.
We want to work with city officials. We want to figure out where to make adjustments. But we believe the heroic commitment of our city workers, the work that they're providing during this crisis, should be matched by our elected leaders in City Hall. We cannot call these men and women heroes one day and then turn around and attempt to balance the budget on their backs. That's just simply unfair.
But, you know, other observers say that the act of instituting furloughs, it might have saved jobs. And the mayor's office is hoping that these cuts are temporary, so a number of those furlough days can be reduced, as we see when the economy gets started moving again and tax revenue starts flowing.
All right, Libby, now this is a proposed budget. So what's next in the process? City Council, I would think, has some say here.
They do. The mayor's proposal is just that, as you mentioned. Now the City Council takes that document and they work their way through making amendments based on the Budget Committee's public hearings, the City Administrative Officer analysis, council member priorities. The council has to pass its budget no later than June 1st, and they can pass the mayor's or they can pass the amended. They'll pass the amended. The mayor then has 5 working days to send it back to them with a veto or tweak it. He can go line by line, but the council then can also override that veto. And at the end of all that, you get an adopted budget for the next fiscal year, which does begin for the city on July 1st.
All right, Libby, I know you are not the Flash, unless you are. You got something to tell me. You can't work your way through a 511-page document in under an hour. So we're going to keep following your reporting and all the reporting on laist.com. That's laist.com. That's a senior politics reporter here at KPCC, Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
You haven't seen how fast I can run, eh?
All right, now let's pivot to higher ed. College courses continue online as professors and students work from home. Summer school sessions are expected to move online as well, and some colleges are even considering the possibility of canceling in-person classes until 2021. But not all reports are bad. In fact, some professors say things are going pretty well under this new system. Last month, we spoke to Dr. Andrea Armani, a professor of chemical engineering and material science at USC, just as she was getting her class up and running on Zoom. Now, at the time, she had just sent off her students with lab kits so they could use them at home, and she reports to us today that
things are going really well, and I'm happy to report that the at-home lab worked.
Oh, good, good.
Yes.
You say that with relief. I can hear it.
Yes, it was an experiment, right? You're always really excited when an experiment works. That's the best thing as a scientist. So, yeah, it was a victory.
Yeah, you definitely sound very happy about it. Now, okay, so a lot of adults are still getting used to using Zoom on a regular basis. We all here at KPCC are using Zoom. Sometimes it works great, sometimes it doesn't. We're all getting used to this new way of doing things. So how has that been working for you?
I've actually found, and I've been talking to some of my colleagues about this, I've actually found that my connection to my students, I think, has gotten better. So my class is at 8 a.m., and anyone who remembers their undergrad years, 8 a.m. classes were not exactly the favorite.
Sleepy time. It's sleepy class time.
Right. Yeah. And I think, if anything, having the 8 a.m. class online has been easier for many of my students. And I found that, you know, now I log in at 7:30, yeah, you know, just to make sure that everything's set up, that my students are, you know, able to log in, that my slides are working, all of that. And I found a lot of my students actually log in early, unlike with in-person classes when students might stroll in a little late.
Yeah.
They're now actually showing up early. And then we end up just having discussions.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's almost like, you know, coffee chat with your professor. And it's really nice. Like, I now know more about this class than I've probably ever known about any students.
That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Like, I know if they have dogs. You know, I know what they want to do after they graduate. Like, I know about them not only as students, but I know about them as people.
So you're talking about a personal connection. That's what you're talking about when it comes to your students.
Yeah. Wow. Yes. And it's really nice. I'm really enjoying this environment, I guess, which I didn't anticipate. But it's always nice when you do something.
How much of that, Doctor, do you think is just the time we're in, where maybe people want something where they can be connected to other human beings better? Or I was thinking, just on a practical level, you know, students commute to class. Sometimes they might have to wake up at 6 and have an hour-long commute to get to USC. Maybe, you know, no commute, you wake up, get some extra sleep, you're a lot fresher and eager to talk in the morning.
I think it's a lot of factors, right? I mean, sure, it could be the commute. It could be, you know, students might just feel a little bit more comfortable almost having somewhat of a barrier, right? You know, they aren't necessarily looking me in the eyes. They feel more open since everybody else is sharing their feeling. You know, we're also having this kind of shared experience right now. There isn't that, you know, oh, you know, Professor Armani is this old person who, you know, is whatever. You know, but it's like we're all going through this really hard time together.
We're talking to Dr. Andrea Armani, a professor of chemical engineering and material science at USC, talking about how she and her students are adjusting to a new online classroom setting. So you mentioned how you're getting a lot more closer to your students on a personal level. How are your students adapting to all of this? Not just the technology and the online classes, but life in this coronavirus age?
I think they're adapting okay. It's challenging. You know, they all obviously have different concerns, right? Some are concerned about, you know, classes. Some are concerned about family members. Some are concerned about, you know, what are they going to do next year, you know, in terms of jobs. So they all have very different concerns. And that's you know, one of the things we talk about in the morning.
But let me ask you this, doctor. So you have this before class. Is it sometimes tough to get class started because you're having a nice time with other human beings, with your students? You're making a connection, but then you got to get to class now.
Yes. So you know, we get to class. You know, it's very important to get to class. I will say I have adapted my curriculum. So my class is a nanotechnology class. We always talk about diagnostics in my class. We always talk about therapeutics in my class. Normally, I would be talking about cancer diagnostics, right? So now I'm talking about COVID-19 diagnostics.
Oh, okay.
I'm able to just pivot. We can continue to have a discussion without interrupting the curriculum.
So because I know you're getting ready to wrap up the semester with final exams. Has that maybe changed the format of your test? How things are going right now? And how are you approaching finals?
So actually, the success of our lab has changed what I'm planning on doing for a final exam. And instead of doing an actual, question exam, which is kind of the conventional formal way you test a student's knowledge, I decided to have my students write their own lab. So the students are going to come up with a lab that their colleagues could do at home, and they have to write, a learning objective. They have to write kind of a background of, why the material that's being tested is important, so a background of the topic, almost like an essay. Mm-hmm. And then prepare a protocol that a student could do at home using at-home materials. And then the second part of the final or summative experience is to give it to one of their classmates, and their classmate has to validate it. I'm actually really excited about this because instead of just testing, are they able to tell me what they've learned, they actually have to apply what they've learned, which is much more rigorous and accurate test of, did I actually teach them something? And as an engineer, that's the ultimate goal, right? Can they apply the knowledge that they've learned to solve a challenge?
So, Doctor, I gotta ask, considering how well you say everything is going, the more personal connection you're having with your students, you're still getting all the work done. If, say, a few months down the road, it's safe enough to go back in the classroom and you're given the choice, go back in the classroom with your students or continue online learning, what would you choose?
So I would say I'm going to adapt some of the things I've learned this semester and try to continue them. So just as an example, the final exam, depending on how it goes, if it goes well, I'm definitely going to do it again. Instead of having an actual question-based exam, I'm going to have my students write a lab. Instead of having, labs that are in the lab, if it's possible, I'm going to try to have some at-home labs. So I'm going to try to adapt and keep some of the things I've learned from this semester in future classes in the classroom.
Doctor, you are a true scientist, taking new information and working it into what you used to do in the past. So there you go. That is a true scientist in perfect form. Now, one more thing, Doctor. I want to ask you about this, because I know you're not just teaching at USC only. You're also contributing to the school's effort to make personal protective equipment and holding virtual events on bio disinfection. Can you tell us more about what that is and how you're involved?
So what we're doing, and I'm actually, it's not just me. I'm working with the School of Medicine as well as a couple local companies. So we're trying to come up with different ways to help clinics as well as hospitals basically clean their personal protective equipment. So we've worked on using existing methods, specifically UVC, which is a wavelength of light, and we've created kind of a portable at-home system or that you can build at home. And then we're donating them to various clinics and hospitals around LA.
That's nice. Dr. Andrea Armani, Professor of Chemical Engineering and Materials at USC. Doctor, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're all trying to get through the coronavirus pandemic together. So new questions undoubtedly will have to come up. Considering that this is a very evolving, changing kind of news story, you might be wondering if some of the things you learned last month still hold up this month and maybe even next month. So that's why we have experts in to review, reinforce, and reassure. Remember, we're all in this together. That expert is coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Due to a backlog of test results that was processed over the weekend, Director of Los Angeles County Public Health Department, Dr. Barbara Ferrer, reported an additional 1,491 cases of COVID-19 today. Almost 1,200 of those cases come from that backlog. She also said the number of deaths in LA County now stands at 617, with most of those deaths among people who had underlying health conditions. But the question on everyone's minds right now almost seems to be about the antibody tests. And for that and more of your burning questions, we have Dr. George Rutherford. He's a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Doctor, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks very much.
All right. Now, before we dive into questions about antibody tests, let's first clarify what they are and how they work.
Sure. So antibody tests, the word serology is also used, measure proteins in the blood that are involved in the immune system, one branch of the immune system, the so-called humoral immune system. Antibodies attach to foreign proteins like the spikes on the outside of a virus and direct the immune response. So for certain diseases like HIV, the antibodies are merely a marker that the infection's there. They're not central to the immune response. For others like polio or measles, they're absolutely 100% critical to the immune response.
Okay,
so that's what we're measuring when we talk about measuring antibodies.
Okay, why are we hearing a lot about that right now?
Well, in the last week and a half about, there have been 90 tests that have come onto the market, 90 tests that have come onto the market. The FDA has basically let loose the floodgates, and there's a lot of advertising going on. And a lot of claims being made that have yet to be substantiated. So it's a real, it's something that's going to take a while to sort out. But antibody testing holds promise for a variety of things, but it's not a cure-all, it's not a panacea by any stretch of the imagination.
Now, about that promise, so what kind of insight could they provide to the ongoing pandemic right now?
Well, for people like me, they're great for epidemiologic studies to understand where the virus has been. What they're not particularly good for is diagnosis, because it takes something like at least 11, 12, maybe as many as 18 days for them to turn positive after infection. So they're not good at picking up acute infection. You know, if you're curious as to whether you had this in the past, okay, well, that's one thing you can do. You can get antibody tests and you can tell that. There's also the other thing that the commercially available antibody tests aren't differentiating are the different types of antibodies. And specifically, I'm referring to neutralizing antibodies, antibodies that are actually involved in the immune response and attached to a virus and lead to it being killed. That's what we induce with immunizations. Those are the ones that are protective, and those are the ones that confer long-lasting immunity. The antibody tests that are currently available, the commercially available antibody tests, don't really separate out the different kinds of antibodies and don't get it at who has neutralizing antibody and who doesn't.
Doctor, one more thing on the antibody test before we get to the questions. Is it, in a way, clouding a lot of the issues, or at least a lot of the questions people have when it comes to just testing in general? It seems like we've got this test and this test, and I think it can confuse the whole issue.
I think it does cloud the issue substantially. When we talk about testing, we're talking about nasal or nasopharyngeal swabs to detect viral RNA. And that's the test where they put the coat hanger in your nose and scrape stuff off. I mean, we actually have better technology than that, but that's what it looks like. And that's what we're really talking about when we're talking about testing. That's for acute diagnosis.
We're talking to Dr. George Rutherford. He's a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Okay, that's out of the way, so let's dive into some questions. One anonymous listener asked, I was very sick in late December and early January with a high fever, cough, headache, and felt awful. I read that it's possible that the virus was actually around earlier. I'm 63, in good health, no underlying conditions. What can I be tested to see? Where can I be tested to see if I have immunity now?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm glad you're in good health and you made it out the other end. The chances of that being COVID-19 are very slim unless you were in China or were in contact with someone from China. There's really no place to be tested yet. And Well, you probably could get a doctor to write you a laboratory order for antibody testing. But again, I would wait, and I've been telling people to wait a month. Maybe it's a little bit less now, to let all these different antibody tests get sorted out and have the ones that really perform well, that can really predict who's been infected and who hasn't been infected, rise to the top.
When it comes to being immune to the virus, because one anonymous listener asked this, are people immune to the virus once they've had it?
We don't know, is the bottom line. And those studies are ongoing. And antibodies are not necessarily a marker for immunity. They're a marker that you've been infected in the past, but they're not necessarily a marker for immunity. At least some people who've been infected who develop antibodies don't have any neutralizing antibodies, which is the part that's protective, the fraction that's protective. So how big that fraction is, what proportion of people that have low or no levels of neutralizing antibody is not known. The currently available antibody tests don't sort that out.
Right. Another question from Joel Juarez. He wants to know, will the Red Cross inform me if I have COVID-19 or if I'm immune to it when donating blood? Is this something that can be detected through a blood test?
These are blood tests, yes. We may eventually get to the point where we can do salivary tests for antibody, but not quite yet. I don't think they're part of the blood donation panel right now. There is, if people have neutralizing antibody, okay, so that's a subset. Or if you've been confirmed to have COVID infection and you want to donate plasma for this experimental convalescent plasma therapy for people with very advanced disease, the Red Cross will be able to take your antibodies and figure out whether you have high titers of neutralizing antibodies. If you do, then you would be eligible to be a donor for that. But they're not doing routine screening right now.
Now, here in LA County, Doctor, citizens are required to wear face coverings when outside of their house. That being said, Mayor Eric Garcetti's State of the City address last night, there were two members of the audience wearing face coverings, not covering their nose. Last week, Doctor, at a hardware store, I saw two workers who were covering their mouth and not their nose. Does this defeat the whole point of face coverings? I mean, how should you wear it to be most effective?
Yeah, well, it's absurd not to cover your nose. You have more respiratory epithelium in your nose than you do in your mouth. So I would, you absolutely have to cover your nose. You also want to pull it down underneath your chin. You see a lot of people where the mask is kind of riding up, sort of up to their upper lip. That sort of defeats the purpose as well. So you want to be able to cover cover both nostrils and your mouth with the thing pulled down, with the mask pulled down underneath your chin as far as you can.
Yeah, I got a little upset at that hardware store, Doctor. I actually said something, and they got annoyed at me back. So that's where that went. All right, a couple of scenarios.
That's the price of being the public police, right?
Well, yeah, but we could go on for an hour on this, Doctor. Okay, so let's throw a couple of scenarios at you. These two come from two different anonymous listeners. Here's the first one. My 13-year-old wants to go bike riding with a friend at La Cañada Flint Ridge. My ex-husband and I have 50-50 custody of our son. I thought we were in agreement with how we're approaching this stay-at-home order. If I say no, my ex says okay. Who is right?
Well, stay-at-home means stay-at-home. If you're going to go, but it does exempt people who are going out for exercise. So if you go out for exercise, though, I think, and I don't know the exact orders in Los Angeles, but you should cover your nose and mouth with a shirt, with a bandana, with whatever you want to wear. And then I think you can get away with it. Now, being around another kid, that's another issue.
Yeah.
And they have to stay, with influenza A, the model of influenza A, which is the closest we have to this, is that the greatest amount of transmission goes on among children, among school-aged children. So I would be, I would want to make sure they were distanced and they were both wearing masks before I let that go down. So you're both right.
Now, this next one is in regards to work. A listener asks, should I work again? I work as a senior caregiver. I only work with one person at their house. However, I live at a home with two older individuals. What should I do? I don't want to lose my job, but I don't want to infect my parents.
Of course. Different places will have different requirements for returning to work. If you're working with older people, they may be stricter. If you're coming from an agency or working at a long-term care facility, like they may want to test you or take your temperature on a regular basis. And I think that's probably the best we're going to be able to do. Older people, very old people, very frail people who get this become symptomatic quite quickly. At a fairly high rate. So the chances of having a 90-year-old that you're caring for develop asymptomatic infection, I think are fairly slim. I think you would know that they're infected because they'll have symptoms, and the symptoms will be fairly dramatic. If you get exposed, then you really should stay away from your parents for a couple of weeks.
Dr. George Rutherford is a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right, as you probably know, the coronavirus pandemic has sidelined sports, all of them, basketball, baseball, hockey. But yesterday, fresh new sports. I'll tell you all about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. If you've gotten a little bored scrolling through all the titles on all the streaming services, desperately searching for something fresh to watch, then I got a suggestion. It has humor, drama, backstabbing, mega personalities, and star power that eventually dismantled one of the most successful runs in history. ESPN has debuted a 10-part documentary series about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls' 97-98 season. That's the last championship in their 6 titles in 8 years' run, one that actually compelled Jordan to retire for a second time. John Horn hosts KPCC's arts and entertainment show The Frame. He wrote all about The Last Dance for our website, LAS. Hi, John.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so what does The Last Dance offer that other things looking at the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls dynasty does not?
It's hard to say it's new because this all happened more than 20 years ago. But for people who are really desperate for sports, that includes me, it is an insight not only into a franchise, but into an athlete. You know Michael Jordan's game, you know what he accomplished, but you don't really know how it all happened. And this is based on some incredible behind-the-scenes footage. Back in 97-98, Adam Silver, who's now the NBA commissioner, was the head of NBA Entertainment, and he persuaded Michael Jordan to embed a crew with the Bulls for a season. They shot more than 500 hours of footage, and the documentary is kind of based on that footage and more contemporary interviews. So it is a warts-and-all portrait of not only one of the greatest players of all time, but also one of the most dominant franchises in NBA history.
All right, so set the scene, John. Where in Jordan's career does The Last Dance start? What was going on at that time?
Well, The Last Dance is a name that Phil Jackson came up with for this season. Jerry Krause, the general manager of the Chicago Bulls, had a falling out with Phil Jackson, and he said to him specifically, even if you don't lose a game all season, you are out as head coach. And Michael Jordan said, well, if Jackson's gone, I'm gone too. So it's going to be the last season for Phil Jackson. It's going to be the last season for Michael Jordan. And on top of all of that, you have this film crew embedded watching everything that's going to happen. So it's really about that season, but it rewinds to look at a lot of different things, how the team came together, how certain players came into the Bulls, the background of Jordan, the background of Jackson, the history of Jerry Krause, the general manager. the Bulls' importance in the city, how bad basketball was before Michael Jordan arrived at the Bulls. So it really kind of puts the whole Bulls story in a larger perspective.
Okay, two episodes aired yesterday. Two episodes will then air every Sunday for another month. You're a few episodes ahead, John. First, what jumped out to you from yesterday?
Well, I think what is most interesting about the series is about how the team is not so much a team of athletes, it's a team of personalities and how those personalities are managed. And Phil Jackson might be a great coach. He's also a great therapist. There's a moment that's coming up where Dennis Rodman decides to go on a vacation in the middle of the season. He says it's only going to be 48 hours. Michael Jordan says to Phil Jackson, he ain't coming back, coach. And there's a scene that happens where Michael Jordan has to go to Las Vegas and find Rodman, who's on some bender. He basically goes into his hotel room where he's with Carmen Electra and drags him back on the team. So those are the kinds of things that I think are most revealing, like the things that you don't know about what makes a great team. And listen, Michael Jordan is an incredibly polarizing figure. In the middle of the series, somebody says, well, there's no I in team. And Jordan says, well, there's an I in win. He's obviously incredibly headstrong, super egotistical, but he's also really good. He demands a lot of himself, and he demands a lot of the people he plays with. And what's most interesting to me is how the team does when it loses. There's a great sequence of events around their rivalry with the Detroit Pistons, who are a better team and a more physical team. So how the Bulls react specifically to that is fascinating.
Now, I can't imagine, John, that anything that has to do with Michael Jordan wouldn't at least touch a little bit, or at least hear from Magic Johnson, who was one of his big competitors back in the day, and also maybe a little bit of Kobe Bryant, who modeled everything about his game and his career after Jordan. Do we get to see any of those two?
We do, definitely. In fact, the fifth episode starts with an interview with Kobe that's heartbreaking to watch, because not only is there archival footage, there's some great moments of Kobe's first All-Star game with Jordan, and there's a more recent interview, obviously, before Kobe died in a helicopter accident, talking about Jordan. Magic Johnson is so generous, and I think Magic Johnson in some way proves that unlike Jordan, you can be a great basketball player and not a total SOB, because Magic Johnson is still incredibly kind and generous. There's some footage of some amazing games between the Bulls and the Lakers. So yes, it does come back to LA. It talks a lot about Magic Johnson, a lot about Kobe and the influence that Jordan had on those players and that those players had on him. And Jordan always compared himself to people like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. And part of what motivated him was this need to be the best among the best. And so that's part of the story as well.
We're talking to John Horn. He hosts KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. He wrote all about The Last Dance for our website, LAist. Now, another interesting wrinkle is that ESPN is offering two different versions of the show. Can you explain why?
Well, one is the R-rated version. It's not that there's any locker room nudity, but there's a lot of coarse language. Nothing too surprising. So they're doing the kind of unedited language version on ESPN and the PG or G-rated version on ESPN2. There's not a material difference, but part of what is most interesting in the series is the filmmakers show Jordan at certain points video of what other people have said about him or a sequence of events. There's a great moment where they show him what Isaiah Thomas said after a game in which the Bulls defeated the Pistons and the Pistons left the court without shaking hands. Let's just say that the Michael Jordan analysis of that video of Isaiah Thomas with the swear words is much more interesting than one without.
Now, John, this wasn't supposed to be out quite yet, but why did ESPN decide to fast track it?
This is supposed to coincide with the NBA Finals in June, but if you are one of the few people who's been watching ESPN lately, they are down to reruns of college football games, guys playing horse, watching athletes play video games. They have no content. So in a way, this is a great panacea for people who crave sports, and goodness knows when sports is going to return, but it really does make you miss the idea of watching live games. And even though you know how a lot of these games are going to end, and there's some famous shots that Jordan makes at the buzzer or near the buzzer to win them, it's almost as if you haven't seen them before. So for a lot of people who are dying for sports, the idea that ESPN has pushed it up is a great relief. And I have to say, Disney is owned by the Walt Disney Company. Their theme parks are closed. Movie theaters are closed. Their cruise ships are empty. It's part of the only, it's one of the only things that Disney has going right now that is, I think, drawing a lot of attention. And I'd have to say, viewers, the early ratings are pretty good so far.
Now, aside from it being something fresh to watch, it is about Michael Jordan, one of the most iconic, polarizing athletes of all time. So I think even if the pandemic hadn't occurred, John, this probably would have touched a nerve with sports fans all over the place. Now, what are you getting out of watching The Last Dance? What nerve do you think it's touching around America?
I was never a huge Michael Jordan as a person fan. I always respected his game and thought it was remarkable. This series has been compared to OJ Made in America. That series, I think, had a lot to say about OJ's world and the larger world. There is no part of this conversation that really goes deep. Jordan doesn't talk about his family. He doesn't talk about his wives. He doesn't talk about his kids. So in some ways, it's a little narrow. There are some comments from people like Barack Obama about Jordan's reluctance to involve himself in politics, especially in a North Carolina Senate race. So it is a little bit isolated in that sense. If you didn't like Michael Jordan going into the series, you're not going to like him coming out of it. But you will get a new understanding of what he demanded and what he brought out in others. And also, I have to say, you watch Dennis Rodman talking about rebounding. He looked at rebounding the way somebody at Mission Control might analyze a NASA re-entry. He was a mathematician when it came to the game. So there's great insight into how players approach basketball that I have to say was news to me.
John Horn hosts KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. He wrote all about The Last Dance for our website, LAIST, that's LAIST.com. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Take care, Egg.
All right, when you start a sneeze, 99 times out of 100, you just finish it, hopefully in a sanitary way. Stimulus, response, starting the sneeze, stimulus, finishing the sneeze, response. But if you've ever tried to hold it back, I mean really gone all out to control what seems uncontrollable, and then wind up successful, then not sneezing is the new response. Well, the act of holding it in, that thing in between the stimulus and response, that has a name. Find out what that name is when Take Two continues.
Will somebody wear me to the fair? Will a lady pin me in her hair? Will a child find me by a string?
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. When author and investigative journalist Scott Carney decides to write about a subject, he literally dives in. 2 years ago, Scott wrote the New York Times bestseller What Doesn't Kill Us, in which he followed the training methods of Dutch extreme athlete Wim Hof and does things like taking freezing cold ice baths and making shirtless, bare-chested climbs to the top of snowy Mount Kilimanjaro. Well, out of that comes his new book, The Wedge: Evolution, Consciousness, Stress, and the Key to Human Resilience. Scott Carney, welcome back to Take Two.
Hey, A, it's awesome to be back.
Awesome to have you back. All right. Now, so right at the start of the book, you make a point to make the most obvious statement I think that can possibly be made, that we're all going to die. Why is that fact at the core of The Wedge? And also, I guess you could say the previous book, What Doesn't Kill Us?
The point is that, you know, our species, and in fact, all life on Earth, emerged like roughly 3 billion years ago. And every creature has had to deal with the stresses from the environment. All of our sensations that we feel ultimately come down to survival. And what this book is about is trying to use our sensations in subtle ways, in a way to sort of make us more resilient to environmental stresses.
When it comes to those environmental stresses, do you think we feel enough of those, just the average human being?
No, absolutely not. Think about your Paleolithic ancestor staring down a lion who's like a mile away and it's charging at him. You're worried about getting eaten. Now, for the most of us, we sit at our in our homes and we contemplate stresses that are existential, that aren't like right in front of us, although COVID is making a little change to that for sure. But in general, you know, you contemplate your 401k and your body releases those same chemicals, that adrenaline, that cortisol that you used to use to fight off lions and tigers and bears, except now that all of that stress energy sort of turns inside and we don't have the physical outputs that we once would have had.
So the humans that came before us, Scott, the ones that for years and years, decades and centuries, they're the ones that have been building up this resistance. They've armed us, the ones that are alive today, with these survival tools.
Yeah, I mean, we have the same basic body as our ancestor 200,000-300,000 years ago. And their environment had real physical stresses that had real physical outputs to them. But in the modern world, we are made comfortable by our technology. You know, you feel a little chilly, you turn up your thermostat. You feel a little hot, you turn it down. And we don't face those real threats that were constant in our past. So what the Journey and the Wedge is about is trying to find sensations and stressors that are in the world that aren't going to kill us, obviously, but that will make us stronger, that sort of enervate our bodies to build resilience.
Okay, so what do you define as the wedge then?
So the wedge is that moment between experiencing a stress, something coming in from the outside, and how your body responds to it. The very first time I ever experienced this was with the Dutch daredevil Wim Hof, who is famous for like sitting in ice water for a long period of time. And I was sitting in this ice cold lake with Wim, and he looked at me and said, "Scott, do not shiver. So, you know, relax. Do not stress out in this environment." And it's hard at first because the cold sort of primes your body to release adrenaline and cortisol and make you like really get into that fight or flight mode. But instead, I willed myself to relax. So I envisioned that as putting a wedge between stimulus and response, like literally building space so that I have a choice in how my body reacts.
But why isn't just eating the right foods and getting some exercise enough?
Because there's three pillars of human health, I like to think. You know, there's diet and exercise, but there's the third pillar of human health, which is the environment, which is always acting on you. Like if you moved from where you are right now to sitting in a meat freezer somewhere, that environment is activating parts of your physiology that you can't consciously just trigger on your own, or at least most people can't consciously trigger on their own. In this book, I ended up hanging out in a sauna with my wife, Laura Krantz, for 5 hours in Latvia, just maintaining myself right below that red line where I just wanted to freak out.
Wow.
And then dipping myself into like just enough cold water that I didn't get there. And then I was able to endure an incredible span of time, which has, it's not just about sitting in a sauna. It's also about changing your anxiety. It's about changing depression and changing the way your immune system responds.
Talking to Scott Carney, his new book is called The Wedge, Evolution, Consciousness, Stress, and the Key to Human Resilience. And sitting in that sauna, with those kind of situations, Scott, that you put yourself in, did the wedge become something more, I don't know, more tangible? Or I mean, I know you already had the idea in your head, but would that have been a better way to kind of make it more real?
Yeah, you know, we really expand ourselves when we are under stressful environments. So, you know, one of the big outputs of this is that I feel more comfortable taking on all sorts of challenges, not just being in a different environment, but taking on risk in general, realizing that I can see what the worst possible outcome is, right? Like I can see, look, I could overheat in this sauna and that would be really bad. And that's like me really going up against death. So when you're facing something that's a hard limit, it makes a lot of the soft limits much easier to deal with. It allows me to act more freely in society at large.
So Scott, if we continue to detach from the environment, from environmental external forces, and attach maybe more to the comforts of technology, I mean, what does that mean for our evolution? What are we doing or maybe not doing for the next generation of human beings?
I think that if we stop engaging in stressors, what we're doing is we're removing pressures that would innervate us, right? That would make us stronger, which is particularly important right now, right? You know, all of us are sitting in this horrible pandemic, right? Where the world, it seems like it's attacking us, and we have crazy amounts of anxiety. And what the Wedge has been very useful for me right now is finding physical outputs for that stress, finding ways that when I'm sort of like freak out on the internet, instead of just posting an angry comment, finding a way to redirect those responses in beneficial ways for my body.
So if someone's going to go out and get the book, your book, The Wedge, but they say they'd want to try something that maybe they can kind of put a toe in the water of the concept that you're talking about, The Wedge, what can they do right off the bat maybe to try it, just to experiment before they read the book?
The easiest thing is to jump in the cold shower and then relax in it and realize that when you get out of it, you feel amazing. You can do these things that trigger your stress responses and then find ways to consciously subdue them and build up overall sort of resilience. And this does translate into health benefits. I don't want to say that the Wedge is going to cure your COVID once you're on a respirator. But what I will say is that when you engage with stresses, when you go up against these things, your immune system gets stronger. You get a general sense of resilience against these things. And that most likely beneficial. But also, you can double down on any physical practice that you're already doing. I mean, there are so many different types of wedges out there, so many different biological responses. But push yourself. Get out there and do something that engages you both physically and, importantly, emotionally.
Scott Carney's new book is called The Wedge, Evolution, Consciousness, Stress, and the Key to Human Resilience. Scott, as always, thanks a lot.
Oh, man, this was great. Thank you.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, just head on over to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. My garden's done. I finished my garden. You can see all the pictures on my Twitter page, at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.